I'll be talking about privacy 101 basic stuff. Many of you may know this, so if you do, chime in with your own ideas. There's really no right or, well, there's lots of wrong, but there's no real only right about this. So if you guys do have ideas, you know, chirp them on. My name is Jeff Termasazen. I work for a company right now that writes call monitoring software. So a lot of the stuff that you guys, when you call into your ISPs, banks, and everything else, it's our software that's busy recording your calls. And I want to be talking about some of the things that you guys do on there that, well, they ask you to do that you do that's not usually a good idea. anyway, start off with the whole idea of what privacy is. What most people think privacy is not really what the legal idea of privacy is. The legal ideas are usually a lot tighter than what we tend to think of as what is private. We also have the problem, a lot of people think, you know, the whole constitutional right to privacy, it is there, but it really only limits what the government can do to you. It doesn't limit what other folk can know about you. I've heard a lot of cases where folks say, well, I've got a constitutional right to privacy. It's like, yes, you do, but only if the government is trying to, you know, apply something to you when they need warrants. The whole FISA thing that they had with, you know, doing the warrantless wiretaps and getting a warrant after the case and that sort of thing. So the biggest thing is be aware of what privacy is. For the most part, I've got a PowerPoint presentation that I'll put up on, I'll send to Scott that he can make available on the EFF site afterwards, either for your guys' selves or for anyone you know, just, you know, real simple stuff. But essentially, it's the quality or state of being apart from from company or observation. So essentially, freedom from unauthorized intrusion. That applies to everyone, but there's a lot more, rather, people know a lot more about you than you really think they do or should do. The Constitution itself covers no right to privacy explicitly. It's everything's implied from essentially five of the amendments in there. First Amendment is privacy of beliefs. Second Amendment is privacy of the home, the warrants and whatnot. Second Amendment is for the soldiers. They can't just come in and, you know, take over there. The Fourth Amendment of privacy of person possessions. The Ninth for is more of a general protection. It's not anything specific the way the others are. And then, of course, the 14th Amendment, which is actually also included into the states' rights. So you're covered a lot under there as to what you can and can't do, or rather what others can and can't do with your information, what they can and cannot know about you, and what you have to explicitly give permission for them to know or for them to know and then use again. Like around here, if you've got the official photographers and whatnot, you're pretty much covered by them by what's in your badge. But the folks who are doing like private pictures and whatnot, they'll usually get the models to sign a release that says, well, we can, one, take your picture, which they can do anyway, but then they can also use that picture on the web, sell it, whatever, based on what's in the contract there. As far as the law goes, you're, like I said, on the federal level, you're pretty much protected from the government, not from individuals. On the state level is where we get individual protections from there, and that's going to differ from state to state. Some states, I know Georgia has an inclusive section on privacy. I think it's the 16th section of the code for Georgia, and it covers surveillance and whatnot. You know, that people can't, you know, go look at you while you're in changing room. They can't go through your records, that sort of thing. Big thing here that I've noticed recently is on our credit card companies. If you go through the fine print, what's in there, they can be really, really hard. Bank of America actually recently upped their rates for pretty much everyone. And I know this because this happened to me. And in the document they send you, they send, yes, you have the right to refuse this, but the way they word it says that if you close your account to keep your current APR, at that point you can't use that account anymore. And once you paid off, that account is closed, which is generally a bad thing because it messes with your credit score. So went through this and said, all right, well, I need to have the account open anyway, so I left it open. They upped it, and then if you call in like every 6 months or so, you can call in. If you've got a good record, you can ask them to lower your APR. And so I called them to talk to them about this, and they were like, no, your APR could have been lowered or could have been kept there if you just promised not to use their credit card at the time. And I'm like, that's not what your flyer said. And says, no, well, that's what we meant. You know, so be careful when you're reading those little disclaimer things there. They can be really tricky. If you're not sure about something, call them and ask, and pretty much always read those things. They're annoying as hell. They're long, they're boring, but they've got information in there which can save you a lot of money, and also which covers your privacy rights. A lot of those folk, a lot of that nomenclature that's in there will be about things like who they can and cannot share information with. Every single one of them will say, we promise we will not sell your information. And pretty much every single one of them says, we can, however, share this information with our business partners, with other third parties, based on whatever else they've got. So they will not sell your information, but based on their business agreements, which is very profitable for them, they will pass it around like candy. So when you're applying for these things, and I'm using credit cards right now because that's my peeve at the moment, but credit cards, signing your mortgages, signing up for anything, even your ISPs, utilities, whatever, read those contracts and see who they share information with. And if you're not sure about something, ask them about it. You can't simply just make these notes and send them in and say, hey, I want this to apply. But you can call them up, and sometimes they do it, sometimes they won't. You can say, look, I want this particular clause excluded, or on this excluded here. Sometimes you can just do it over the phone, sometimes you have to put it in writing. That's going to depend on them. Call and ask them. Sometimes they'll just tell you to go take a jump. Sometimes they are nice and, you know, they'll put that kind of thing in. A lot of the information that we get, a lot of the junk mail we get, is spread through that way. Now, for the most part, it's harmless. It's name, address, it gets you those credit card offers, the credit bureaus who keep your information there. Companies like LifeLock say they can go do it, you know, block off that stuff there. That's all stuff you can do for yourself. They just make it easy for you. But those are a huge, huge source of information that pretty much anyone can tap into if you have a business license. They can't get information like your social security number or your credit score because you have to actually pay for that. But they can get your name, they can get address, they can get aliases, they can get past residences, they can get family members, they can get a whole bunch of top-level information about you, which can make it very easy if someone's if someone's trying to get information. As far as securing your privacy goes, there's really only so much you can do. If someone's actually after you, they're going to get your information. So the most you can do there is make yourself very aware of what's going on, that as soon as something does happen, you are aware and you can start shutting it down. However, that's rare. I don't think, you know, it's very seldom they will actually target someone. So most of the folk who are after information are simply scanning. Who can we find? Who's easy to get hold of? What information can we get? You know, who'd basically be an easy mark? And everything we're doing here is essentially trying to make it not worth their while to come after you. Yeah. Most often this happens the most common one you have in this is ID theft. They get your social number, they open up credit cards in your name, possibly get birth certificates issued. It's really, really a big deal, especially in this country with as much that's tied to your social security number as it is. Most common methods for this are things like dumpster diving. I'm sure you all know what dumpster diving is. Anyone not know what dumpster diving is? All right. Skimming. Anyone not know what skimming is? All right. Skimming is like a little credit card reader. And what they do is they will go to an ATM, and a lot of ATMs have got like insert things where it actually takes your card and then pulls it in. What they will do is they will paste this little scanner over that. This is one method. Paste the scanner over it, and that little scanner's got a built-in power supply and a built-in reader. When you swipe your card, all it's doing is just recording what's in that card information. Usually there'll be like a little camera or something near it or above it that they can see what the top of the card looks like as well. And then from that, they've got physically what's printed on the card, which is usually your name, the card number, expiration date, if they're lucky, possibly the little security number on the back there. And then by actually swiping it, they've got everything that's actually on the card itself. Other ones I've seen have been complete fake ATMs. They'll come to something like DragonCon, they'll pop out to the food court, drop an ATM in there that looks all very official and whatnot, but doesn't dispense any money. All it says is like insufficient funds, bad card, something along that line. And all they're doing is just collecting these credit card numbers, information, that sort of thing. When you go to these places, keep an eye on sort of what you're doing. The biggest thing here is basically be aware of your surroundings, be aware of what you're doing. Pay attention to, most banks tend to use the same kinds of ATM. So if your bank uses a swipe card, great. You know, if it starts looking a little bit odd, looking different, that sort of thing, and the rest of it looks the same, there may be something fishy on there. Or if your bank usually uses the ones that actually take the card in and suddenly using a swiper, there's usually a hotline on the side there that you can call. Sometimes the jobs are really, really good, but most of the time the guys are pretty much trying to see what they can get away with. So if you're paying attention, you can normally see that these things don't quite look right. Call the number, report it. The worst you've done is you've told them, hey, you know, there's something going on with a legitimate ATM, and they'll come out and check it, and that's fine. Best thing, you may save someone hundreds of thousands of dollars based on what they're going to rack up there. Phishing, you guys all know what phishing is. Everyone's gotten those phishing emails. Hey, this is the bank calling. You know, please log on to our site. Big thing you want to check there is look at the web address. Don't look at the one that's actually printed in the email, because they will always look legitimate. But most browsers will actually show you the physical address that it's going to in the status bar. And most of the time, it'll, let's say, it's, yeah.
I would add to that.
Yes. Yes.
So there's actually a couple years ago they allowed people to start doing Unicode domains, and so the Unicode is 16-bit characters, and so there are actually Unicode characters that look like standard English characters, and so what they can do is they can register a domain that looks like an English word, but really has the Unicode characters from another domain. They can then get a valid SSL certificate from any of the major certificate authorities, and that way when you click on the link, it'll actually say it's a valid SSL certificate. It'll look like it's fine, but it will be going to a third-party site. And finding those is tricky. Internet Explorer and Firefox have some features to catch that, but they don't always work.
Right.
So really, if you ever get an email from your bank, just pay a lot of attention. And if it gives you a URL, don't click on the URL. You know, type it in yourself, and that way you know you're going to the domain you think you're going to, because all of that stuff can be faked if you're sophisticated enough.
Right. Changing your address is a popular one, where they may get onto the post office and they fill out a change of address card, and suddenly you stop getting mail, and you go ask the post office what happened, and said, well, you know, you've changed addresses, and someone else will be getting all your bills, all your mail, everything else there. Simple old-fashioned stealing. Pickpockets, someone stealing your wallet, stealing the handbag, pre-approved credit card offers. I'll be getting to that a little bit later on, how to kill those. Checks, like when you reorder from the bank. Tax information, getting your W-2s, that sort of thing. Big time check is around about whenever your company starts getting their W-2s. It's usually a good idea to ask your HR to let you know when they actually mail them, and then keep an eye out for it. Because if you haven't gotten in a few days, go back and ask them what happened here, because you know someone may have been intercepting things there. And then also something called pretexting, which is false information. Also, that falls into social engineering. Someone calls you up, hey, we're calling from your bank, and you know, we've picked up a security violation, you know, that sort of thing there. Best way I found to deal with those there is actually say, give me a number, I'll call you back. And it's easy enough, if the number looks suspicious, you simply call the bank itself, you know, look up the website, say, hey, I got a call from this number, is this one of yours? They can look it up and say, yes, this is, or they can actually transfer you to the department that would be handling your particular case, you know, based on the information they give you there. But yeah, biggest thing is use common sense, be aware of what's going on, make sure you know what you should be getting, and then if anything looks anomalous there, start asking questions. As a culture, we've kind of tended to get away from asking questions. We don't like questioning authority. That's especially true, well, with banks and stuff now, where they're selling off their debts to debt collectors and whatnot. I don't know if you guys follow the news very much, but all the stories about the cases that are now starting to come up against various debt collectors, especially up in New York, they use all kinds of threats. The debt collectors, we're lawyers, you know, if you don't pay us, you're going to jail. You know, if we don't get some sort of payment for you on the phone right now, deputies will come at your house, you'll be arrested in front of your children. They're really, really nasty about it. And don't be afraid to sit up and say, it's like, no. It's like, I need more information than you're giving me here. I need proof of what you're telling me. Anybody who's not willing to identify themselves, anybody who's not willing to identify the company they're with, and anyone who's not willing to let you talk to a manager or supervisor or something and give you information that you can then backtrack is pretty much not someone you want to be talking to. A lot of times they will work in teams, so you'll be talking to like your first level agent. You're not sure about some things, so all right, let me go get my, you know, my manager. They come on that little bit more hard line about it. You're still not sure. They'll go get then get their manager or the director or the senior VP or whatever, and they start getting nasty about it. But again, they'll be hesitant to give information that you can get back to them on. They will say, well, we'll call you, you know, we'll contact you. You can't really contact us for whatever reason. So if it sounds suspicious, it's probably going to be. All right, privacy arenas. There are really four main ones, and most of the ones that I could think of under this came under one of these four. They were essentially online, where you've got an active connection to the internet. PC, where you are on a computer, but you're not necessarily online. Personal items that are things related directly to you, your wallet, credit cards, that sort of thing. And then other real-life things which are involving you but aren't yours as such. Things like mailing lists, signing your name up for petitions, for drives, that sort of thing. On each one of them, I want to talk about the source and then a defense against those there. And this is really where I want you guys as well. If you guys think of any more, please pop in with that. Most common ones for online are essentially banking, banks in general, pop-ups from all manner of sources, and email. Those are usually pretty much the main places that people get infected on various things there. Banking sites, obviously, like I said, you get the emails from the guys coming in saying click here to go there. General websites, you're browsing along, pop-ups come up, you know, click here. I actually got a call from my sister-in-law the other day saying that she'd been browsing a site and something had popped up and said her computer was infected. And it was showing her like a printout of what was on her hard drive and things and saying, hey, you've got viruses and whatnot. And essentially it was the old, you know, write the domain back to the file versus the HTTP address, and it gives you a directory listing of what's in your system. And so she didn't know what was going on, so she gave me a call, and then she gave my brother a call. And we were like, no, don't click there. Just kill it. You don't want to go there. So if it's not something that you're aware of, especially if it's not some of the antivirus that you have installed, avoid it, kill it, you know, pop into Task Manager. Yes?
Question on killing it. Sometimes I've had something pop up, and, you know, that I didn't want, and then I figured, well, you know, you have the choice of okay or cancel or something like that.
Right.
You have a box, you have a little X in the top right. Usually, I'm going to take the X in the top right, but I'm going to ask you about that. But I've actually had a situation where it hit the X in the top right, and then I have something else pop up and say,
right,
well, you know, if you really want to do this, and then you say, well, okay, and then you have an okay or a no or something like that,
right,
and you don't know which to hit to get out of there.
Right. Best way for that, I'm not sure where the command control on Mac is, but on both Linux and in Windows, you pull up the task manager for that. Under Linux, you either do the PS to get your listing of processes. Under Windows, just control, delete, and pull up your task manager. And see what browser you're running in. It'll iExplorer, Firefox, and just kill it from there. Kill the .exe file that's running in there.
The what?
The .exe file. You'll see like a list of programs that are running. And it'll be like Firefox.exe or iExplorer.exe. And one good way to see which one's the active one, because probably have more than one listing, is if it gives you the little box, just move it around real fast and see which one clocks up the processor speed. Then that's the active one. And then just click on it, and at the bottom you'll have a button that's, well, in Windows, a button that'll say kill process. Hit that, and it'll say, you sure? Yes, and it'll kill that exe out for you. You can also do...
That closes out the whole browser.
That particular instance of it.
Oh.
So it shouldn't kill your other back... If you don't mind doing it, just kill everything that says Internet, that says iExplorer.exe or Firefox.exe. And eventually you'll get to the one that's bothering you there. Under Linux, you're going to get a process list, and it'll give you all the process names there with a ID next to it, a PID. And from the command line, you can just type kill and then that number, or kill minus 9 and that number. And it'll kill that process as well and take it away from you without you having to click on anything there.
Have you heard of something like that?
Oh, yes. Yes.
And that is that ever an honest thing?
No.
That's always a dishonest thing?
Yes.
Yeah. Pretty much if it pops up in a web browser, like if the active window is a web browser window, you can probably bet that it's someone.
Right.
You see, that's you have anything you can do. You can minimize the window, and if it minimizes to a Firefox or Internet Explorer to a web browser, you know, then you know that it's in the web browser. If you're not sure if it's like Norton or Internet Explorer, minimize it, see what process label is. When you get one of those windows, this is network.
Hello.
Oh, there you go. Okay.
When you get one of those windows, you can, if you can't tell whether it's a web browser window or an actual security program window like Norton, what you can do is you can minimize it, and when it minimizes, it'll normally minimize on Windows and modern versions of Windows. It'll collapse into the stack of all of the web browser minimized windows. So then you know that it's not actually a piece of security software. It's just a web page that looks like a piece of security software. And if it does that, then you can just close it because you know that it's just someone lying to you with a web page.
Yeah, because it doesn't look like a web page.
Right.
It doesn't look like a full browser.
Yeah, they can make it not display the
right.
The menu bar up at the top. They can make it just display content so it looks like a security program, but it's not.
Yeah, because usually what it is, when you see that second one, it's usually not a full web browser as such. It's normally some Java code or some basically some sort of executable which looks like it. And that's essentially why when you click on the X, it doesn't kill the program. It's actually executing code that says, all right, run the second program versus just simply closing out the window. So a lot of times it looks like a normal web browser window, but it's not.
Well, that brings up the question that could you click the OK closing it?
No. That's the thing is, as soon as you see that, you don't know what they've programmed in, because I've seen cases where it doesn't matter what you click, you're going to go to their website.
Well, that's what I was trying to figure out. Is it safer to click the top right to get out of it?
Top right's about as safe as you can get. So, right. Because if it's like a Java window, where the whole thing is actually a Java window and it's a Java pop-up, even that little X is not really an X. It simply looks like an X and it's going to still execute code. But that's as safe as you can possibly get.
I don't run Java. I run only JavaScript because I've been afraid of Java. I didn't know if it did something.
JavaScript will do the same thing.
Oh.
It really depends on who wrote the code. There's so many ways to do it, and they can do it without using Java at all. They could use PHP. They could use...
Can you get an executable file to start by clicking on an X?
Yes.
Yeah.
Yeah, you can have it. They can set it.
They can set it to automatically download an .exe file, and if you have Windows set up incorrectly, it'll automatically execute that .exe file, and then you're really in trouble because
right.
Once they start executing custom code, you don't know what they're doing. Turning off Java is generally good. At least once a year, there's a major Java vulnerability. So if you don't have an actual use for Java, turn that off for sure. Set your web browser to not execute programs automatically. Just have it execute no programs. Specifically, like if you have a Mac, I know there's a vulnerability where Macs by default would open up PDF files, but you can embed Flash in PDF, and the Flash that comes with Macs is insecure. So you'd go to a web page, it would automatically throw you a PDF, that would automatically execute a Flash program, and then the Flash program would have the code to exploit your computer. So you definitely just never want to have anything open. And what will happen, when you have it not open automatically, it'll pop up a screen saying, do you want to download a file? And if it ever asks you to download a file that you haven't specifically requested, then you say no. And that's probably the safest way.
You didn't comment on JavaScript.
JavaScript is just another language. Java, it's used for different things than Java, but it's one of many languages on the internet that they use to execute code.
Is it reasonable to leave it off?
That is, there's a lot of debate around that. A lot of,
only when you need it.
If you turn it on only when you need it, a lot of websites just won't work. that's the problem. JavaScript is so built into the way people design websites these days that it really diminishes the utility of the web without it.
Well, there's a lot of third-party plugins that'll let you control that, like NoScript, one that I use in Firefox. And when you get to a page, it gives you a list of what is actually running on that page, and you can say, "Oh, I trust Google. You know, I'll let them run stuff." And oh, I don't know what this is. I don't care. I don't want it.
Yeah, I mean, if you're worried about that, turn off JavaScript and just see what you know, like. Go to Google. Go to Gmail. Go to whatever web pages you normally use and see what they look like without JavaScript. A lot of them will work. They just won't work as well. And it all depends on how paranoid you want to be and how much time you want to put into making this, you know, making your computer as secure as you want it. Because there are tons of pieces of software you can go out and download that each do a very specific small thing that help you out.
Right.
But to go into all of them, it would take a lot of time.
Yeah, and you wind up killing your system anyway because you've got so much protection running. Your system doesn't run properly anyway then. Generally, as a safe bet, I set everything to always prompt. I go through everything in my settings, and anything that I can set to prompt, I set to prompt. It's a bit annoying, but that means that anything that happens, it's going to always ask me, what do you want to do? Then if I come across particular sites that I use frequently, you can always add an exception in for them and let them run, you know, without prompting you. But the default is always prompt. Yes?
As something sustainable for us, maybe, who are more concerned about privacy, I think that's a great solution. But what should I tell my grandmother, who is not going to even know what the prompt means?
How much do you like her? How much should I spend explaining things to her?
Let's assume she won't remember tomorrow, no matter how carefully I explain it.
Non-technical people generally don't tend to browse around wildly. They normally pick their few favorite sites and tend to stick to them. I'd sit down for like a day with them, go through their web browsing history, see what they've got, simply block off the ones that are actually dangerous, and configure their system for them. And then tell them, if you see this, basically says like, do not go here. Don't go there because bad things will happen. And for the rest, you know, tell them usually to say no on a prompt unless it doesn't work. If it doesn't work and they go no, tell them to go back and then say yes. You can really only do so much. There's no way you can completely, you know, proof something against someone who's adamant about clicking on everything. Probably the biggest problem that folk have is simply all the pop-ups. Like, you know, the biggest thing, one of the biggest problems they have with corporations are those little custom smileys in the emails and whatnot. This, you know, the admins and the low techs and whatnot who love making things look pretty, love those smiles. Problem is that they look innocuous, but there's a whole bunch of nasty code that runs in the background of those things. And eventually got to the point that many companies simply lock those down. It's like, all right, we gave it to you, you couldn't use it properly, so you can't use it anymore. And if it gets to the point that you're having to keep going to your grandmother's house and keep fixing things, you may have no choice but to either say, look, you either need to live with your machine dying, or you're going to have to live with me locking this thing down that you can't do this anymore. Yeah.
One thing that that I have not done to any of my grandparents, but I know a lot of people who have, is to set up their computer and not give them the administrative account. When you get Windows, the first account that gets set up is an administrator account, which has full privileges. Well, the average user never needs full privileges. You only need full privileges when you want to install software that has to write to the registry or do other funky things. So set up two accounts, an administrative account, which you use to go in and do work, and then give them a normal account. Because with a normal account, you can browse the web, you can do your email, you can do everything that the average user is going to need to do, but they won't be able to corrupt the entire system. Plus, by doing that with modern operating systems, you can also get remote access, and then if you need to fix something, you can log into the remote account. You can log into the administrative account remotely and not have to drive to your grandmother's. The other thing is Linux. I work for Red Hat, so I'm a real big fan of Linux, but what I would suggest for people's grandmothers is Ubuntu. The Ubuntu distribution comes in a live CD. You stick it in, it does its thing. It has web browsing, email, word processors, everything. And by default, it's just a lot more secure.
Yeah. Yeah.
Well, I have actually done that. I have given a number of people who have basic computing needs, and especially with no previous experience, I've given them Linux because they're going to have to learn anyway.
Right.
Who cares? But I think if that gets too popular, against the sort of things that are typically done to end users, I'm not sure how much more secure it is. If I wanted to write a piece of malware for Linux, so they say I find a Firefox vulnerability on Linux that will let me execute code through a web page.
Right.
That's not far-fetched.
Right.
I don't know any off the top of my head. That's not far-fetched. There's not really any difference between that and Windows. It doesn't need root to run and look through my email.
True, but the biggest difference there is how fast that problem gets fixed. Because Microsoft has got a vested interest in not letting people know that their stuff is full of holes. So when they find a vulnerability, they will usually keep it quiet to try and fix it before it becomes widely known. The Linux community usually says, hey, there's a vulnerability, you know, first past the post, you know, see who can fix it the quickest. So a lot more people know about it quicker, but you also get the solution much faster and you get a whole bunch of different solutions for it.
There's also how often you'll get attacked. And this is just something that's right now. But right now, if you compile code to attack a operating system, you have to compile it for that operating system. An attack that's going to affect Windows is probably not going to affect Linux or Mac OS or the Mac OS X. Now, Mac OS X is actually one of the least secure operating systems out there. If you look at the number of known vulnerabilities for it and how long it takes for them to actually get patched, Macs are not that great. But no one writes attacks against Mac computers. There's a couple reasons for this. One is Apple isn't hated the way Microsoft is. Another is that if, you know, 95% of the population is using a specific type of computer, you're not going to attack the 5%, you're going to attack the 95%,
right,
because there's many more targets. Linux is like Mac. Fewer people actively attack it, so you're safer just because the chances of someone attacking you is slimmer because they don't see the benefit from it. And you're right, that is just based on what the way the world is right now, and if everyone started using Linux, people would attack it more. But, you know, you have to deal with it right now as well as in the future, and right now it's a valid tactic, even if in 10 years it may not be.
We were actually just talking about botnets in here the last hour,
mm-hmm.
And there have been recently a couple of Mac botnets, and this is kind of a new thing. Nobody was really attacking Mac OS until recently, and I think now it's a softer target right now, because not only are there maybe more security holes in the OS, but the users are complacent.
See, here's the great thing about the Mac botnet. I've actually been reading up on this. Most botnets propagate through viruses and people downloading things and executing them. A lot of them propagate through them being attacked. Like, you log onto the internet, you don't have a firewall up, they use a remote exploit. The Mac botnet is actually where someone put a copy of Microsoft Office with a Trojan up on up on BitTorrent. And so the people who are affected by that botnet actually had to go illegally download software. So the other thing is, if you're illegally downloading software from BitTorrent or some other site, you're going to have to deal with things like that. I mean, if you go out of your way to break the law and bypass, you know, those things that our society says you should morally do, like pay for goods, then, you know, you're asking for trouble.
Yeah, you're pretty much getting what you deserve.
Yeah, but there are Mac botnets, but again, right now, the only one I know of is limited to people who have downloaded software illegally.
And yeah, and that's actually another big thing that you want to stop people from doing is downloading software illegally for that reason. Because a lot of times folk will stick up popular software specifically to infect computers. You know, they'll actually load the software, and that won't just do the software as well, they'll load it with movies, pretty much anything they can get their hands on that people want. I don't know how many of you remember the Kournikova picture that went around like 10 years ago.
Yeah.
Supposed to be a naked picture of Anna Kournikova. That was probably one of the biggest infections we've seen in computing history. The funniest one that I saw of that was that a Marine Corps 3-star general I actually got infected by that one. And I was like, all right, I guess the military is not invulnerable. As far as defense, well, I was speaking about some defenses here, but on a personal level, what you want to do there is, and that's kind of annoying because it does mean that you've got to sort of study up on your own. There's no real easy, quick solutions to this other than don't get online. If you're getting it online, though, you pretty much have to do some studying on security if you want to be safe. Most ISPs will offer things like antivirus software for free to try and get folks to sign up with them. You can buy, a lot of the folk are doing like home networking, usually buy routers. You can buy routers with firewalls in them now. Depending on how big your home network is, you may want to install a separate firewall. You can do NATing, which is a network address translation, which basically means that your computers are not directly addressable from the internet. They've got to go through some address translations to get there. Antivirus, malware, spyware software that you can get. Some of it's good, some of it's not so good. It does take some research. Norton's actually, Symantec, has recently actually rewritten their entire antivirus code to be quicker, faster, less of a footprint on there. You can download some pretty good free ones as well, but they're going to take up more space. They're going to run slower because they're not making any money of the folk who are downloading the free ones. They want you to download the ones you got to pay for. But things like AVG is pretty good as far as free things go. Malware and spyware, things like Adaware, Spybot. It's just a sad fact of life. If you're not on the internet, you need to know what the current stuff is, download it. If you really don't do a whole lot on the internet, you can maybe get away with once every couple months checking. If you're on the internet a lot and you're constantly downloading things and whatnot, you want to check a lot more often. Pop-up blockers as well. Pretty much all the browsers now have pop-up blockers built into them. I think Microsoft pretty much was the last one to jump onto that bandwagon. There are a whole bunch of third-party pop-up blockers as well. And then for the most part, use common sense. Don't download pirated software. Don't go to sites with wares in the name. Be careful of where you're clicking. Don't just randomly go clicking, see what you can click on the internet. And if you do, make sure that you are running good firewalls, everything else, because a lot of the times the stuff that looks safe, even just on systems, is often not. I don't know if you guys are familiar with the term honeypot, which will be a computer that someone sets out there specifically trying to lure folk in. Usually it's set up by white hats trying to get black hats in. Just be careful. Use common sense. If you shouldn't be there, yes?
What was it you said? Don't go to sites with where, something
in
the name.
Where's. What it is WARZ. And usually it's pirate sites, it's pirate software. Wares was sort of like the generic term that they coined for anything relating to pirated software. All right, PCs, just straight, not being online stuff, again, pirated software. It doesn't have to be stuff that you're downloading off the internet, it can be stuff that your friends are giving you. Unknown software, USB keys, CDs you don't know, that sort of thing. We were talking to the gentleman at Frontier about running automated installs and whatnot. A bank, I believe it was Regions Bank, hired a company, security company, to go and do some testing for them on social engineering, which is essentially getting passwords without actually breaking into the networks. You're talking down to folk, you pretend to be a supervisor, you're like, oh damn, I've got to get this report in, I forgot my password, hey, can you help get me into the system that I can download my, my thing that I can get up to the boss? They came up with a nifty thing where they wrote a self-installing Trojan which would run a keylogger and then mail them the results once every 24 hours to a Gmail account. And they dropped this onto USB keys and just let the USB keys float around the parking lot, the break rooms, that sort of thing. And they got something like a 60 or 65% hit rate on that one. Because it wasn't really the users who were at fault there. They were to a degree, but in that case, more the IT department who weren't locking down the machines like they should have. Because what they do is they pop the USB key in, USB would automatically read it, software would go, hey, there's an EXE in here, let's run it, and bang, you're infected. In that case, fortunately, it was a benign one. The company knew about it and whatnot, but I'm pretty sure if you do the same, well, don't do the same thing because it is illegal if you're not being asked to do it, but someone who's doing it illegally would get a very good high hit rate on some very sensitive systems for things like that. Yeah.
So there's actually been several cases where people who make viruses have got them into the manufacturing process of cameras and MP3 players, and so that when people bought devices from the store brand new, the factory settings would include a virus. And so if you're, those generally get caught very quickly because the first, you know, someone buys a device, plugs it in, and then sues the maker, and the maker tries to fix it as soon as possible. But anytime, if you buy any sort of device that has storage on it, or if someone ever gives you a USB key, I get probably four or five small, 64 meg USB keys given to me a year from various companies, you know, always handle those with the utmost care, because that's a very easy way to get software onto someone's computer.
What is the utmost care?
I'll go over that in a second here. I've actually got 5 points that cover most of what you should run into as day-to-day users. First off, buy your software. Simply because, as he says, you've actually got legal recourse then if something does happen. You can go back and say, hey, you may not get anything out of them, but at least the software will get fixed quick, fast, in a hurry. Disable auto run. Don't let things run unless you know what's being run. This is where you set your stuff to prompt you if something's going to run. Confirm your download locations. Yes?
Question on that one, though. Something I wondered about, when I put a CD into the computer, on that one I've left auto run on because I feel that allows the music to play. If I disable
You're fine there. Just don't stick in CDs you don't know then. Like have a second drive or something that is set up to block that.
Also for a Windows operating system at least, you can tell it what type of media, depending on what type of media
right.
you put in, you can tell it whether to autoplay or not.
Right. So if it's an audio CD, you can say auto run audio CDs but not data CDs. Yeah.
Well, I see a couple problems with that for the end user. The end user is not necessarily going to make a distinction between a CD full of MP3s and an audio CD, especially when they have their car stereo plays MP3s, their home entertainment system plays MP3s.
True.
So I think probably the best thing to tell users is open the program yourself. So put in something with audio files on it, open your media player.
Well, that'll be the prompting of it. Yeah.
It's not really much of a burden on the user to do that, but it keeps anything from happening automatically.
Not always, because I haven't seen some AVI files and things which have had viruses embedded in them. It's not a common thing, and it depends how it's set up, but I have seen cases where they... especially things, are you familiar with the term called ADS, alternate data streams?
Thanks.
Okay, essentially what it is, it's a way of linking an EXE to a non-EXE program. The most common way of doing that is through like a text file or something. If you set up an ADS stream into a text file, you'll have your physical text file as it is. And if you open it up, if you'd like double click it, it'll come up as a text file in whatever you've got, Notepad, WordPad, whatever, and you can type in there, save it, and it'll come up there. However, if you drop down to the command prompt and you actually run it with the ADS tag on it, it'll actually run an EXE file, whatever EXE has been linked to that particular file. And the problem with that is it's very hard to track those unless you're specifically looking for them, because there's no real trace on the system about that file being there. If you do a directory listing, there's no EXE listed. If you do a scan on the text file, you'll scan just the text file. If you actually even do a hard drive scan, that EXE does not exist on that hard drive because it's essentially buried as an alternate data stream. The only way you can do it is to actually download something that checks for ADS streams, and it'll then tell you all the files that you've got on the system that are tagged as ADS. So in general that works, yes, but it can be circumvented. Yeah.
Has there been any, with antivirus and anti-spyware companies, has there been any research into automatically detecting alternate data streams that don't belong there? Like the one use I know of for it is for NTFS to be able to use all the macOS files that have a data fork and a resource fork. So there's
that I don't know. That I don't know, but I've got some contacts over at Samantha. I can pop that question to and ask them. But yeah, I'm not sure if anyone has been doing it or not. I don't think it's really financially feasible from this time, because while it's possible, it's not really a common thing that folk use ADS. That's normally when guys are getting into forensics, or anti-forensics rather. They're trying to hide data more than trying to, you know, trigger Trojans and whatnot.
Actually, that's what I'm getting at, is that legitimate uses for it are rare and probably easy to enumerate. We know that most people are trying to use ADS.
Right.
And the people who are using it for something legitimate, we know who they are and what they're doing with it. So it should be fairly easy to write a utility that looks for any unknown uses of ADS and then red flags them.
Probably, but again, I'd have to ask those guys there and see why they aren't doing it. Yes?
Sysinternals at Microsoft has
utility
with Scan Greencast.
Okay. Is that the one that's over on safe.live.com?
If you go to Sysinternals,
right.
I think it's bought out by Microsoft.
Yeah.
And they have a whole list of really cool utilities,
one of
them
is quite close to ADS. Okay. Well, there you go. You can run it from there. Run antivirus before you execute a program. If you download something, and I do this every single time I download a program, even if I know where it is, right-click, scan file. If it comes up clean, you assume that your antivirus is up to date, and you assume that you've been downloading from a source that you know, you should be fine on that then. And then lastly, if you're not sure about something, use virtual machines. I think Microsoft's recently come out with a free one, and you can pretty much download them off the internet as well. They're not particularly sophisticated, the free ones. The ones that you have to buy can be really, really good. But what a virtual machine is, allows you to boot up a computer within your computer. And so if it runs and something gets infected, you simply turn off the virtual machine and it's gone. But it'll allow you to test out software if you're not sure about it, or run things. It's a very good way to run forensics and anti-forensics on things that you're not sure about, to see, you know, are there bad files in this particular batch. Yeah.
There's also VirtualBox from Sun.
Yes.
Free if you're not using Windows, or even if you are.
Right. And it does take some time to set up, but again, you know, it's a balance between how safe do I want to be versus how inconvenienced do I want to be. Personally, I'd rather be more inconvenienced than, you know, have my data all over the internet.
VMware also has free software to do the same thing.
All right, personal sources for this. Credit reports, credit card offers, credit card statements, checks, name, address information, payslips, all treasure troves of places where people can get personal information on you. One of the biggest ones I've seen is on checks. How many of you put your full names on a check? All right, drop it down. Use first initial and last name. If nothing else, like with my name, if I put Jeff on there, they know I'm male, first off the bat. If I put G, they've got no idea if it stands for Jeff or for Gina. I could be, you know, whatever as far as that goes. Many have the option of putting your social security number on the check. Keep it off. And if anyone asks you for social security number, find out why do they need it. If they want to use it as an identifier, tell them you want an alternate identifier. For a long time, the ID, you know, social security cards, actually, I think it says not to be used as ID, and they kind of dropped that, I think, in like 95. But you can actually request. I know a lot of universities and stuff have moved away from that. They start assigning you a random student ID now instead of using your social security number. So if someone wants to use your social as a ID, tell them, I'm not comfortable with this. I need you to assign me a non-social security number. Even if it's still a 9-digit number, that's fine. It's not your social security number. Anyone wants your social, ask them, you know, exactly how will this be used? What will it be used for? How will you be keeping it? I know I recently had to do something where they needed my social, and they did actually need it. So I wrote it down for them, and when they were done, I took their piece of paper back again, because I've got no idea if they're actually going to destroy it properly, whereas I know I'm going to get rid of it properly, and no one else will get it after that. So be very wary about information like that. Same thing with credit reports. If you print out your credit reports like you really should, most states allow you to do it once a year. Georgia allows you to do it twice a year. Take advantage of it. Go and check your report every 6 months. That's the free one now. I mean, you can check it every day if you want to pay for it. Find out what's in your report. what should be there, what shouldn't be there, and don't be afraid to go and say, hey, this is wrong, or this is what happened in this particular case. That all has to be logged. It may not come off of the report if you argue something, but they will tag it with a note that if anyone's running a report on you, that note will show up as well. Yeah.
I was going to say about the Social Security numbers. There's actually been an interesting attack against them that was developed in the last few months. It shouldn't affect anyone probably under the age of 35, but Social Security numbers are reused, but they're reused in a systematic way that blocks of numbers are assigned to specific locations. Well, what's happened is after the first generation of people got their numbers, which was pretty random, when they started reusing the numbers, it was public knowledge where those numbers were assigned to. So that if they know what city you're born in, and what year you're born in, and you're the day, they can guess your Social Security number. So one thing you have to watch out for with that is just because you haven't given out your Social Security number, if you're young, that doesn't mean that someone can't figure it out without too much difficulty. It's something like a 10% chance of them being able to guess it on the first try, and who's to stop them from multiple tries? So for Social Security numbers, just watch out for that, and that's another good reason to continually check your credit reports, is because they don't even need to hijack your information sometimes. If they can get your name, your where you were born, which is a common security question, you've got your password, please tell us your mother's middle
right.
name or what city you were born in. So there's other ways to get that information than actually giving it out.
Yeah, and actually for that, all that information, I put false information for all of that. I know there is a pattern to it, so I don't forget it. But the answers to those questions are not the actual answers. So if someone gets that from me, they still can't use it. Credit card offers. A lot of times they come there pretty much pre-filled out. All you got to do is sign it and send it back in again. There's usually a very convenient space where it says, if your address has changed, please fill in your new address here. Really, the only way to stop those is to call the banks and tell them to drop you off of there, or even better, call the credit agencies and have your names removed from there. I know LifeLock was the first one that started doing that, where they would essentially bother them, I think it was like every 30 days or every 90 days that you had to renew it. One of the credit reporters actually sued LifeLock for that because they were like tying up all their lines, and their judge ruled against them and said, you guys offer the same service, you can't sue these people for, taking advantage of what you guys are doing as well. That's why I've recently seen that there's a whole bunch of new sort of services that come out from the credit reporting company that do the same thing LifeLock does. So find which one you're comfortable with, take advantage of it, get your name off of those lists there. If you really want a credit card, go to a bank and say, hey, I want a credit card. You're probably going to get a better luck talking to someone who will actually run your report, that they'll ask you about any things that look odd on there, than someone simply going through a piece of paper on there and saying yes, no, with never even talk to you.
Don't use LifeLock. That's another very important thing. The service actually does nothing. They're famous for putting the CEO's Social Security number
right.
up on all of their advertisements. About 6 months ago, a report came out. His identity has been stolen 25 times. He has lost tons and tons of money on it. He claims he's using his own service. So if his ID's been stolen 25 times, then it's they tell you they can protect you, but there's nothing they can do that you can't do yourself.
Right.
Basically, they tell you that they're going to keep an eye on all of your transactions and your credit report and all of that, and they'll be able to identify if you've been attacked. And they tell you that they'll actually protect you from attacks, but there's no way to really do that. And so they take your money and they give you a false sense of protection.
Right.
And that's what they do.
but what is it?
They're getting sued. The government's going after them. They're a bad, bad service.
Essentially, what they do is they call up the credit card. They call up the credit reporting companies and say, put this person onto the do not share information list. And then you pay them, and then they pay their reporting company to run your credit report like on a daily basis. And if you're like based out of Georgia and suddenly you've got a credit application in Alaska, they'll go, hey, that looks suspicious, and start following up on it. But that's all stuff you can do yourself. Yeah.
They have something kind of equivalent, which may make a little more sense for some people. And I've seen them offer to a lot of the major insurance companies, and that is like identity theft insurance, which kind of is essentially if your identity does, something happens if someone's using it.
They'll supposedly fight the illegal. They'll do the actual fighting for you. So instead of you having to contact all these people...
Read the fine print on those things very carefully, because it is so easy for them to put in like one little line that's, you know, that's something along the lines of, this will take effect if you've taken all reasonable steps. And what that reasonable steps is kind of a nebulous term, and they may define it as you've been going to the credit card companies and saying, hey, take my name off these lists. So if that's how they define it, which they don't list in the fine print, and you haven't done it, they'll come back and say, well, your insurance doesn't count in this because you didn't follow what we consider reasonable terms. So it's not a bad thing to do, but call them up and grill them on every little thing there. It's like, what exactly do you mean by this? And don't just talk to them. Get them to send it to you in writing. If it's not in writing, it doesn't exist.
Also, with credit cards, you're not liable for if someone takes your credit card number and uses it.
Right.
Now, with debit cards, you are. And so one thing I always suggest is banks give you, hey, we'll give you a debit card that also acts as a credit card. Never take those. Always get a separate debit card and a separate credit card.
Yes.
And never use your debit card anywhere other than, like, the actual bank.
Just because it says Visa does not mean it's a credit card. Yeah.
But an actual Visa is backed up. So it's a little bit of a pain, but it's when someone uses your credit card, you can normally just call them up and say, hey, this isn't us. And so getting someone else to do that, paying someone else to do that, versus taking one phone call, isn't a great value. And there are other companies that do that do similar stuff as LifeLock. I've just read a lot of bad things about LifeLock. I mean, the fact that they tell you the CEO uses it, but they don't tell you, well, it's failed 25 times. You know, that's vital information for the transaction, I think.
Right. Right. Pretty much how you can defend yourself on this over here is shred everything that's got identifying information on it. Nothing leaves my house that has anything that can be tied back to me on it. I don't know this page here, but this is what one page of shredded looks like. And it's really hard to put back together. It was a printout of an email from Gmail. And I try to put this thing back together again. It can be done if someone's really, really interested in it, but it's a pain in the butt. Yeah?
And get a really, really good cross-cut shredder?
Yes. Because do not get strip shredders, get cross-cut.
And you want to get ones, I know Staples have them, I'm trying to find before. It's 1 millimeter off in one direction to shred secret material for military grade secret. The other thing is that they have software. You literally just put the pieces on your scanner.
Right.
And it scans it. You have to go ahead and turn it over, scan the other side, and it automatically puts the document back together for you. So you really need to cross cut.
Yes, absolutely cross cut. All right. Hang on, I'll get you a second. You can get a whole variety of them, because I'm actually researching them to kind of like give ideas on that there, but there's simply too many. You get some that'll do like almost, well, it's also called confetti shredding, but you'll get some that do like little squares, and those were running up into the thousands of dollars. Most of the ones that should be effective for the most part are like these. They normally do about a 3 millimeter wide and probably about 2 to 2.5 inches long. But ideally, buy as expensive as you can afford that does the smallest possible cut. Because the smallest pieces are going to give you harder to put back together again. Yeah?
Yeah, that one that I talked about there, they're like this thing.
Yes.
It was $179 instead.
That'd be perfect for that. Yes?
What about burning?
Burning works great as well. First shred, then burn, though. Unless you're standing over and watching that it's burning there the whole time, a lot of time if you're simply burning in a pile, a lot of that heat can blow half-burned piece of paper up in the atmosphere and blow it across and settle down where, you know, you want to... They'll have nothing... The whole page will be destroyed except for your name and social security number.
Watch out for inks, though. I don't know if you guys have heard this, but a lot of printer inks are actually really bad for your health if you inhale them, and I can't imagine that burning them would make it much better.
Yes?
Now, I never talk a lot about how people can protect themselves. One thing people don't look at is the fact that a lot of the things that are occurring are actually occurring through very trusted companies. You know, I think like PSW also
had
numbers.
Yep.
And there's almost nothing to do about it. You know,
no.
These are, you know, if you're using Amazon.com, the Amazon.com exploited you, you know.
That's where it's come back and watch your credit reports. Because if someone has exploited you on that there, because that's actually where I got involved with Bank of America, was that they wouldn't tell me the name, but some merchants had been exploited there, and my card was one of the ones that had been processed of like 13 million cards or something, and they just closed my account. They're like, well, it's a security precaution. I'm like, well, great. Thanks for my credit report on that one, because now I've got a closed account that I didn't want closed. But yeah, that's where you got to keep watching your credit report, because if someone does use it, it'll show up in your credit report as a application, as a charge. Even if you're not aware of it, it'll eventually come up as that this person did not pay in there, and now, you know, we're going to start filing bankruptcy things against them because it's gone out to a claim court because you owed $5,000 and no one ever heard from you. Yeah.
Another problem I've seen is the complimentary checks that the credit
yes.
card companies mail you, essentially, in the, especially around like Christmas time.
Yep. Shred those things. Don't even try and use them.
Well, the problem there was I once had my identity stolen from someone who got the mail that
yep.
had sent me in, got it right out of the mailbox. And after I got it taken care of, I made sure that they told me not to even mail those things.
Yep. And sometimes it will, sometimes it won't. I'm trying to get the AJC to stop swinging this damn newspaper they keep sending for months now. And they take it off for a couple of weeks and then it's right back again. So one of the things I'm actually considering is going to the post office and documenting what I've done and say, hey, these guys are harassing me, and see what the post office will do about it. Because the post office, once it's in the mail, the post office isn't allowed to stop it. But I'm hoping that, you know, if someone says, hey, these folk are harassing me via the mail, then that'll give them some more powers to stop those things from coming through, if only to go back and tell the AJC, hey, we've had a charge filed against you that you're harassing people. What's going on? All right, we're about done here. One other thing, you had a graphic on here earlier about the Wi-Fi usernames and passwords and stuff that was up on this big screen over here. You didn't see it? All right. I don't know. Did you guys all see what's up over here? There's like a big grid thing, and it was like usernames, passwords for what they've collected on the around the web here. When you guys are using Wi-Fi, anything that's free, distrust. Doesn't mean don't use it, but distrust. Because I'm assuming this is what you guys have done here, is that someone connects up to the hotel security and then makes themselves their own Wi-Fi spot, and they will label the Wi-Fi spot as free internet. Everyone hops on, you know, pops on their laptop and goes, hey, free internet, connects up to there. Use something like, there's a whole bunch of programs that'll do this, but essentially they will track the traffic that's coming from your computer to whatever they're using as a router. Anything that goes across it unencrypted, they will have access to. Your usernames, passwords, the whole kit and caboodle. So if you're doing something on there, like some of those look like emails and stuff, use SSL.
Anybody named FSB.
Use SSL, use encryption. There's a bunch of third-party encryption software that you guys can use for this. If you're not using it, turn it off. Unless you're actively using your connection, keep it turned off. If you're actively using your connection, keep it as short as possible, and as far as possible, keep it encrypted. You will probably have to pay for that, but it's a difference of paying a couple hundred dollars versus having your username and password up on the board of DragonCon. Because I'll be willing to bet those are all still valid and probably be valid well through the weekend. Because, you know, I don't know where you guys got them from, but, you know, if you walked out here and set up a Wi-Fi hotspot, you would get many hundreds of people connecting to you over the weekend. So, yeah, with that, that's the end of the thing. It's 6:30. Thank you for coming.